Hi, you're listening to Irish Stew, the podcast for the global Irish nation. I'm Martin Nutty, and together with my co-host John Lee, we're working to bring all the Irish together, whether you're hyphenated or not. We'll be talking to Irish people of excellence about their lives, what they do, their successes and failures, and how they relate to that small green rock off the coast of Europe. If you like what we're doing in this space, please remember to subscribe to Irish Stew, and even better, leave a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another serving of Irish Stew, the conversation for the global Irish nation. I'm John Lee, and here's my co-host, the authentic Irish ingredient in the Irish Stew, Martin Nutty. Martin, you look fresh, fit, and dangerous. Looks like you've been getting a little bit of sun. How are things out in Amagansett?
Well, I'm just suffering on the beach there, John, but somebody's got to do it. I have the smell of the sea right now on me.
It suits you. But for our global audience, where is Amagansett? And what's that all about?
It's out on Long Island, which is nearby New York City. And the reason why Long Island is called Long Island is because it's actually very long, and it's about 90 miles out towards the tip of Long Island. And it's kind of a nice, quiet beach getaway.
Sounds like a Native American name, correct? Amagansett?
Yeah, I would expect so. So you either have very British names out in Long Island, like Southampton, right, or you have things like Amagansett or Shinnecock. And then probably one of the more famous ones is Montauk, which is the very tip of Long Island.
We'll have to have a Irish Stew retreat out there next summer. We mentioned the globe, so let's spin the globe and see where Irish Stew lands this time. And it looks like it's going to be Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Martin, of all places. Well, our guest tonight does hail from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, but he spends almost as much time in New York or in the air, going from here to there to business events all around the country. He's been a small business owner, a political operative, a C-suite executive at a Fortune 100 company. He's written at least four business books. He's an in-demand keynote speaker, and he happens to run his very own media empire. I think we're all going to look forward to speaking with Jeffrey Haislett.
Is that all he's got to offer? I thought you were going to book a good guest, you know?
He's a man with a lot of projects, a lot of energy. Well, here he is, Jeffrey Haislett. Jeffrey, welcome to Irish Stew.
I could not be more pleased to be here.
Good to serve up another ladle full with Mr. Haislett in the house. Jeff, say hi to Martin Nutty, the authentic Irishman in the room.
Hey, Martin, good to talk to you. Good to meet you. You're looking great, my friend.
Yeah, just straight out of the surf in Amagansett. I'm a happy camper right now.
So when we have stew, is it with crackers? It's got to be with crackers right now, I would think.
That's pure savagery. Just not allowed.
But you know, Jeffrey, one of the things about our Irish Stew is we're open to all kinds of international influences. It's a new take on Irish Stew. That's what we're doing.
Yeah. I love it. I love the name and I love the whole concept. So I'm just so pleased to be here.
Yeah, well, you and I talked about this basic idea quite a while ago, and we'll get into your kind of media empire. But, full disclosure, one of my jobs in the past was producing All Business with Jeffrey Haislett and securing the guests. We had a great time, and I learned an awful lot.
Yeah, we were on CBS Radio back then, but now I've gone off and taken that entire network, at least the CBS Radio portion, the business portion of it, and I created C-Suite Radio, which is now the world's largest business podcast network as a result. So you were there at the beginning, John.
Early days, early pioneer, early mover in the market.
Yeah. Well, I can remember sitting in a room in a conference room in New York City as we planned out how we were going to create that show, what the show was going to be like.
Exactly.
And it's totally different than it was back then. It was an hour long show. We had breaks. We had blocks of time. It was and now, I've gotten it down to a little bit more like 24 to 26 minutes. We're on the clock and boom, we're done. And but yet we're still growing as a podcast, which is great.
Excellent. Well, I'm stealing from you every chance I get.
Please do. That's what most people do. I mean, why would you want to reinvent it when it's already there? Just copy and flattery. That's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that.
Excellent. So, Jeffrey, you know, we talked earlier before you came on about your career in sort of general terms. I describe you as a man on the move. What keeps you moving? What keeps you on course? And how do you even chart your course?
Yeah, what keeps me moving is paying the bills. I mean, you got to, no matter what you're doing, and no matter how big you think you get, there's always someone bigger. But, you know, I've got my own personal conditions of satisfaction, which for me, it's about, you know, learning new things. It's about having fun. And then it's also about building wealth. I think, you know, you have to be able to pay the bills. And some days, right, especially right now with all we've seen with COVID, it's a little tougher for people to do that, and myself included, all of us, you know, it's a challenge. And so you've got to be innovative. But the biggest thing, John, and you know me and know me for a while, I like to do new things. I like to try it. And usually when I get to the point of where I've done it, then I move on. You know, mm-hmm. I've been a Fortune 100 officer, corporate officer, you know, bought and sold over 250 companies in my career. You know, 25 billion in transactions. So I've done those things. And then once I've done it, I'm now next. Mm-hmm. And I look for the next thing.
Yeah. You always kind of made us nervous in the office, Jeffrey, when you were like, suddenly there was another business we were launching.
Yeah. Well, I tend to do that. I mean, you know, what the heck? I mean, you're going to fail. And there's no question about it. We're always going to fail. I think the key is not to fail fast, but to win fast. And so, you know, even now I tell people as I'm building this whole thing called the C-Suite Network, C-Suite TV, C-Suite Radio, C-Suite Book Club, you know, everything with C-Suite on it. We own hundreds of IP around that. And I'm building the plane as I'm flying it. You know, I'm smart enough to know I'm not going to crash it. Been around long enough. I get a little close to the ground from time to time, but you know, but by and large, though, I know where I'm going and know where I want to get there. I don't always know how I'm going to get there, but I know I'll get there.
Hey, you use the word crashing, and I want to use that as a segue into another part of your career, the Fortune 100 company part of your career. And I'd like to turn it over to Martin, because we had another discussion with another guest on the Irish Stew, and there was a discussion around a company that was going through its Kodak moment. And I'd like to turn it over to Martin to kind of drill you on that.
Well, I'll try not to drill that much, but I have a tendency of actually using the Kodak moment where I see companies that have kind of a blind spot and they have an impending thing crashing down on them. And little did I know, obviously, I was going to sit with somebody that had a front row seat on that experience. Yeah. And it struck me that it was surprising with Kodak, of course, because they invented digital photography. Their whole background is obviously in photography, and how they did not manage to navigate that particular transition. So can you throw any light on that? I'd be really curious to hear.
Yeah, Martin, they navigated it. They navigated into bankruptcy over time, but you know, so they just navigated it very poorly. They ran aground. You know, it's amazing with a company with, you know, had, you know, so many thousands of patents, one of the most inventive companies in the world, you know, started back in the 1800s with George Eastman, and has this huge history of, you know, imaging science and material science and bringing the two together to create, you know, all this imagery, and actually created a Kodak moment, which is now known for something totally different. You know, and they in the early 90s invented digital camera and then pawned it off on Apple and everybody else with the grace of an Anaconda, you know, swallowing a rabbit. I mean, they're a behemoth, you know, and what they did was they just forgot who they were, Martin. They got caught up and a lot of companies do this. They catch themselves in stories of I'm this or I'm that. And people do that, right? They think, oh, I'm not a good swimmer, or I'm not a good singer, or I'm this, or I'm that. You know, we hear these little voices, and Kodak had the same thing happen to it. It had its own voices in its head that said, we're a film company. And if you think about it, they were never a film company. They make, they manage, they move images and information. They created the Kodak moment. They created a very celebratory brand. And yet they pigeonholed themselves into this belief that we're a film company. And had they grasped that we're an imaging company, that we help people make, manage, and move images and information, you know, I call it the MP, you know, MI3 squared. that then they would have known, that they could have done much more than that. And that was hard. You know, by the time I got there in 2006, it was like the writing was on the wall, but, you know, could we try to turn it? Could we make it? But I mean, man, that runway was so tough. And, you know, you got to imagine we had hundreds of buildings. We had a, you know, five fire departments right there on the property. I mean, for as far as you could see, I could see Kodak from, you know, from the executive office of, you know, my office. And so it was very tough and really difficult for them to overcome that. But that was it. I mean, you know, that's where the hubris of your own success kills you. And, and you just, you believe this story. In fact, you know, here I am 10 years later, 10 years away from the company. And I actually heard someone give the same exact quote that I heard the first day I was there. They said that their website's the most visited page, you know, their photograph on the website's the most visited page in all of internet, you know, and back then that probably was, although I even questioned whether that was true back then. But, you know, how you get stuck in a story on this, you know, and, you know, even great actors that you see who start to become a caricature of themselves, you know, or you know, a musician or whatever. And you have to learn to reinvent yourself. I mean, and that's what we should have taken from George Eastman. I mean, he's one of the smartest guys, one of the most brilliant guys. You know, his dream was to make photography as easy to use as a pencil. And he did.
Yep.
And he did, you know. Every camera today, if you look at every cell phone that's out there it has Kodak technology inside of it. And nobody knows that. I know that because I helped negotiate those licenses. I was there when we were doing them, but yet, you know, we didn't, you know, we lost it. Martin, you just mentioned, sorry, you put the quarter in, you get to go for the full ride with me, brother. That's the way it works.
I'm good with that. The color is fascinating. Let me ask you this question, Jeffrey. The first book I think that you wrote was The Mirror Test. I'm guessing that probably is tightly related to the whole Kodak.
There's a lot of lessons in there, although the word Kodak was only used, I think, 17 or 27 times. I can't remember which one, because the attorneys made me redact everything.
Somebody was counting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, that's the way a big corporate. I mean, that was part of their tight. The guys were so tightly wound, they, you know, every time they bent over, they tore their shorts. So, you know, it was a real problem, you know, driving change in a company that says they're all about change, but never want to change is a real problem. So, yeah.
The other thing I noticed about that book, interestingly, was in the introduction, and this kind of twists to our audience, our listeners, the opening introduction is talking about a CIA man that has arrived in Ireland to meet up with an agent. And I'm wondering exactly when you kind of tapped into that whole Irish thing. You know, I was doing a little archaeology, so.
Hey, that's pretty good to pull that. I forgot about that story. That's a great Murphy, Agent Murphy. I'm looking for a man named Murphy. You know, I'd always heard that we were Irish. You know, our family came here, but I didn't know. And it was actually, quite frankly, when I met John Lee that I started turning that on and saying, look, I got to go find this. I want to know where my family is. What's my history? And I'd always been kind of a fan of Ancestry.com. So I'd started, you know, in the pre-Ancestry.com, I can't remember the name of the company that I was doing a lot of research and had the software and was doing that in the 90s and that kind of stuff. So I started finding all these things of our family and what the history was and tracing it back. But and then, of course, you know, it was great to go do the 23andMe thing and be able to confirm that I'm a majority of Jeffrey Hazlett is Irish and then a little bit of everything else, but a majority. But doing that, tracking down the family, grabbing the family history, you know, we found out we migrated here in 1757, landed in Philadelphia, a great, great, great grandfather and a great, 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 great uncle who then went on to serve in the French and Indian Wars under George Washington. Yeah. And then went on to become, the leader of the Delaware Regiment of the Continental Army. And
so you were a son of the Revolution then, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Our family's from way up north, in Derry, which I've learned to say that correctly. Let me tell you that.
Well done, you ever been?
Yeah,
if you ever, John Lee must have been coaching you on that one, Jeffrey.
Well, he did, but I tell you, the best coach I ever had was in Irish. You know, I love Irish pubs. Mm-hmm. I just love the feel. Of course, number one restaurant in all the world is an Irish pub because of of the migration out of Ireland. If you start studying that's the number one restaurant in the world. And but I love a good Irish pub because you know what you can get, and the people are always great, and they got great whiskey and great scotch, and so that's what I like to do. And I have my favorites in New York that I love to go, like Scallywags. But nonetheless, when I'm sitting in an Irish bar, and one day I said, no, my family's from Londonderry, and the Irish bartender from behind the corner goes, Jeffrey Maylie, let me tell you something. If you ever say Londonderry again, I'm going to come over and punch you in the face. You know? and he was serious as hell. He goes, your family, he says, you're from up north. And if you're from up north, and there's no London in any part of the earth, your frickin' vocabulary.
I was going to say, that's when you're kind of questioning, like, maybe I don't want to get into this whole thing.
That's when you go pick up a book and you start reading, you know, and I read 1919. I can't remember. Was it Coghlan? And then I started reading a lot more and then understanding the depth and breadth of that. You know, I knew a lot about some of the trials and tribulations that, you know, went over between the North and kind of what you'd say the South, but not to the extent that any American would know unless you've really been close to it. And of course, I've been a former, you know, United States Senate and House staffer and had seen some of that stuff, but not to the extent, you know, because I was too busy out working, doing other things. But now, you know, became a real fan a fan of history there, and then a student of history. And then in doing so, you know, I've been introduced to some great, great people. And, you know, and I've been back to Ireland now, a number of times, and I just enjoy it. And so maybe, you know, who knows? Maybe someday I'll have a piece of property there, a real piece of property. And I love it. I love going back. I love being there. I've gone back to the ancestral home. I've gone back to our original farm. Not out about let's say it's about 12 miles outside of Derry, in a place called Strawderry, and along the Roe River. And I've actually, you know, climbed into a river where there's a rock with our family crest.
Oh my gosh.
On a very rainy day that a farmer let me climb through his fields to go and see.
And, but Jeffrey, you already have that square meter of property.
Yes, I do. I'm a squire. Yeah, John and I, you know, we bought one of those so we could call ourselves a squire. But, you know, that was fun. And still, I have it around here somewhere. I have my proclamation that I'm a squire. Yeah.
If you don't mind, I'd like to rip you out of Ireland again for a moment and send you back to Rochester, New York. And you mentioned politics. And I want to talk about your kind of maybe your exit strategy out of Kodak that involves a certain current president of the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us.
Well, I was looking to do something to promote the products of Kodak, and we had an inkjet printer which we had launched, and we really wanted to put it in the forefront. So the team and I were doing a lot of brainstorming in my conference room one day, and I said we need to put the product on something like the Apprentice Show. And this is back in 2007 2007. When we were working on it, and then I said, why don't we go put it on Apprentice with Trump and all that? Let's go put the product on there where they have to do do some kind of task and compete, and then we're at the forefront of it. It's called product integration in the marketing language. And so someone said, hey, well, how do we do that? And I said, well, call Trump and find out. And they go, we don't know Trump. So I grabbed the phone and called the information, got out through to Trump's office, left a message. He called me back 15 minutes later, and you got to know how to leave a good message, you know, for a guy like Trump. I just said,
so what exactly was that message then? The inside line, please.
Yeah, well, I got a hold of the receptionist, and she put me through to his assistant. And of course, I said, hey, I'm Jeffrey Hazel, Chief Marketing Officer of Eastman Kodak. I can speak to Mr. Trump. And she said, I'm sorry, he's busy. I said, I thought he might be. Could you take a message? Yes. I said, here's the message, Rona. I said, Rona, would you tell him I have $2 million to spend with him in the next 30 minutes if he call me back? If he can't call me back in 30 minutes, that's fine. I understand. We're moving on. I just, you have 30 minutes. Here's my phone number. You now have 28 minutes left to call me. So You know, so yeah, that's the message. And I, you know, somebody said, did you practice that? I said, no, I would say, hey, no, I'm Irish. I'm bold and brass. And that's the way we do it. You know, that's what we're, it's in my roots. So nonetheless, that's the message. You call me back. And of course we tried, he told me about the apprentice was canceled. It wasn't going to go back on it. So that's too bad. You know, what would be a cool. And then he tried for the next 10 minutes, trying to talk me into sponsoring his golf tournaments. Which you'd expect from him. He's a total sales guy. And then I said, no, that doesn't fit for us. Not the good audience. You know, we're all about the chief memory officer. And that's a woman. She does watch the show and so forth and so on. And so I said, but you know, it'd be a cool show. It would be a celebrity version of that. And he goes, oh, that'd be a great idea. He goes, would you do the show if we could get that on the air? I said, I'd do the show. Sure. He goes, well, would you tell Mark Burnett that? And I said, well, I don't know Mark Burnett. And of course, Mark Burnett's a big producer, Survivor, and all these other shows. So he gave me his cell phone number, and I called Mark Burnett after I hung up with Trump. Woke Mark up because it was like 9:30 in the morning, East Coast time, 6:30 California, and woke him up on his cell phone. And you know, apologized, but we talked, and a month later, they approved the show. And then I became a judge on the show for the next 3 years. I was the officer from our company and so forth. And so my team wanted me to do the show. And so I did it and I always brought in another team member so we could balance it from a male female perspective. But did the show, worked with him. And then, of course, afterwards worked with him a little bit on Miss Universe, Miss USA as well, because he owned that franchise with NBC at the time. And worked with Paul and their team and trying to turn that around. It was great. It was good.
So that's the origin story, I would guess, of you getting involved. Let's call it the media arts. Would that be correct? Or had you played
exactly.
around with that before?
Yeah. Yeah. And from there, that led me to do my own television show on Bloomberg. I was a host of the number one business show on TV. We had the C-suite with Jeffrey Hazlett, where I took you into the C-suites or the boardrooms of companies where 99% of the employees in a company never get to see, and would tell you behind the scenes what that was. And that, it was all from, as a result of that, that, you know, then Forbes put me on the cover and named me the celebrity CMO. And, because business people weren't doing TV shows like that at that time. Right. And so that was, it was new. And our episodes stood out because they were always controversial. We always had someone fighting. I, got to fire Gene Simmons and then had to go back on the show at the end and debate Gene Simmons live on the set of Saturday Night Live. And, and then he would go after me on Conan O'Brien or on Jimmy Kimmel, and I'd defend us. So it became I made the story and of course I was, as long as they kept talking about Kodak, I didn't care. You know, it was great.
So I guess you didn't kiss him off nicely then, huh?
Yeah. Well, let's look at Trump. Trump today. Geez, my goodness. He's, I think most of us would say he's batshit crazy, but you should get used to calling me ambassador. That's all I got to say.
So I've got a question along that front, right? So obviously you've had a number of encounters with the current president. How do you tread that line? As a businessman, because I know a lot of businessmen don't want to kind of stake out a position where they love the president or hate the president, and especially, given how polarized the country is now. So how do you manage that?
Well, in my last book, which I wrote, it's a hero factor, which, talks about putting people above profits and the fact that we need more, more business hero culture. You have to pick a side. Look, let's be clear. He is a friend of mine. I see him up close. I've seen it. I still see him up close. He's a certain kind of guy. Now, when you see this public persona, it's a little different. Now, I'm not saying that that's a good thing or a bad thing. It just, that's what it is. So why I can still like you as a friend doesn't mean I'm going to vote you for president. Yes, Martin, you and I might get along, but we might not drink the same scotch, and that could really well tick me off, right? but we'd still agree to drink scotch together. We still agree to do things together. We still agree that we're Americans. We still agree that we're you know, for the country. You know, I thought, you know, John Kasich is now supporting the Democrats.
Sure.
But the former governor of Ohio, I think he said it best after the election. He was on a talk show and they said, "You're now supporting the president." He goes, "But you ran against him." He goes, "Yeah, it's kind of like being on the plane and hoping the pilot does a sucky job." Right. You know,
right.
You know, that's something you want to do. So, you know, I think you got to look at, you know, let me tell you, not to get political, but let me tell you the one thing Trump's done. I tell you the one thing he's done that's great for this country is the fact that we're all picking sides. We're all doing, it's raised people's awareness to at least go this way or that way. That I think is a good thing. And now I don't like the way we had to get there. I certainly don't like the stuff that we see today, but as a business leader, I love it. I love the fact that you either hate them or you love them, or you love this or you hate this. Now, what I don't like is the discord that does not allow for the tolerance of other opinions and tolerance of other values and options for people to do what they want to do. That I don't care for. And you should vote accordingly as a result of that. You should write a check to the candidate of your choice. But what it's done is it's got more people active and involved than ever before. And the result of what we had in the last election, quite frankly, is a result of that inaction, that not picking of sides, it's caused the mess that we're in now.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So,
okay. there you go.
Yeah. No, we love it. I remember you, you spoke, I ran into you on the street one time, and we just as the Trump thing seemed to be real, and we exchanged some thoughts, and then you spoke at an Irish Business Organization of New York meeting, and that's the first time I heard the batshit crazy line. So you did mention that there, and you said everything was going to turn out okay. So I'm going to hold you to that, Jeffrey.
Yeah, well, it's America. I mean, we have good things, we have bad things, but in the end, it will. Look, say what you want. He won the election.
Yep, he won. Absolutely.
There were millions of people who voted for him. Will that happen again? We'll wait in 60 days. But, but in the end, you know, I want to say no one's going to die, but that, I can't. I don't want to say it like that because that's not the climate that we're necessarily in. But goodness will always prevail. It just takes time.
Hey, I'd like to, you know, goodness, speak about life a little bit, your life and all that. You know, when I worked for your PR arm, Tallgrass, the business card said offices in New York, Los Angeles, and Sioux Falls, South Dakota, because we can.
Right.
What is that about? Why do you run a business from Sioux Falls, South Dakota? Come on, Jeffrey. It's C-suite.
I think right now you can run a business from anywhere. But, you know, South Dakota is my home. It always has been. I have a place in New York City, but also South Dakota. In New York, I got to be in New York for obvious reasons around the media side and the things that we do. And of course, that's where a lot of business is, you know. But South Dakota is a place that I can choose to be there, and I do. And, you know, there's more people in the stands at Indianapolis 500 the day of the race, the entire state of South Dakota, you know. During 1 week of the summer, you know, our entire population of the state doubles when, you know, everybody comes for the Sturgis bike rally. So it's a different kind of place, and it's to me a very spiritual place. So it's a place that I choose to come and reground, and to put my feet and smell the earth and step outside and see the rest of the world. And to me, it's a very unspoiled place. So I like to be there. And so listen, and I'm sitting here right now, 9 miles outside of town, in a little tiny ranch area, or, you know, we'd call it a farm. Everybody else would call it a ranch. And I'm only on 40 acres, so it's a very small place. But, you know, and across from me is the oldest bridge in South Dakota, which I happen to own. It was built in 1898. The five previous bridges that were wood before that burned down, so they finally built one of steel. And the bridge doesn't go anywhere because it's no longer, the roads were abandoned many, 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 many decades ago. But yet I own that bridge. I see mountain lions, I see bobcat, I see river otters, I see bald eagles, and I have 1 gig internet speed up to my home. So, hey, yeah, okay, I'm here. I can do business from here.
That's great. Yeah, I've been out there, and I've seen the bridge, and I know you will defend the bridge at all costs, Jeffrey.
Oh, I have a cannon every 4th of July. I put a cannon on the bridge, and I invite the neighbors, and we shoot the cannon off because, you know, I live about 2 miles from Iowa. You can actually see Iowa from my house. And in case Iowa ever, you know, invades South Dakota, I am prepared to defend a bridge.
See, Jeffrey, I thought you were just, you know, out in South Dakota as an advance man to get Donald Trump up on Mount Rushmore.
Well, I think there's a debate whether he's going to be on the front side or the back side of that.
Hey-o, hey-o.
No, nonetheless, there you go.
You know, I just want to hit you with a little Sioux Falls trivia, see how up to speed he is.
Uh-oh.
Sioux Falls has two sister cities. Can you name them?
Should be Winnipeg, Canada.
Sorry. According to Wikipedia.
Winnipeg is one. There's one that's a German city. I can't remember. By the way, it was the very first city in Eastern Germany after the war, after the wall. But I can't remember the name of the city.
Yeah, I know. But there's one other that we located in Wikipedia, and that would be Newry in Northern Ireland.
I had no idea about that. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
There's like three Irishmen here in South Dakota. There's not a lot. It's mostly Scandinavians. Everybody's Johnson, Nelson, Olsen. Right. You know, they're all Scandinavian. They're either Norwegian or Swede or maybe a few Danes.
So how did the family fetch up in South Dakota? That's a long way from the coast where they landed in Philadelphia, right?
Yeah. Well, the family eventually migrated down to Western West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was then Virginia, which became West Virginia. And my father was in the military. And so we moved from, state to state to state to city to city to city. That's how we did it. And so we ended up we were stationed in South Dakota a few times while my dad was in the Vietnam War. And in the early 1969-70. We were stationed a couple of times in South Dakota. And then when my dad came back and I was like 16, my parents divorced. And I just always remembered South Dakota and Rapid City. And it was just, Martin, to me, about the most heavenly place I've ever been in my life and still is. And the Black Hills of South Dakota, for just some more trivia, which is known as Paha Sapa, the native Lakota or Sioux Indians, consider it to be a very sacred place. And so, it was just a gorgeous place. So I got a chance when my parents divorced, my dad moved back. He got restationed in South Dakota. I said, I'm going to go live with you. And that didn't work out too well. So I ended up moving out and I've been on my own ever since I was 16. And, but South Dakota has been it's been my home. And then I met my wife, Tammy, and the first day of college, very first day of college. And I've been smitten ever since and been married to, you know, we've been together for 40 years.
I just want to talk a little bit. Obviously, we kind of jumped right in on the whole Kodak thing, right? But there's obviously a long arc from when you graduated from Augustana in South Dakota and fetched up in Kodak. So just looking at, stalking you on LinkedIn, it looked like you were in the printing business originally, which makes sense that you would fetch up in Kodak. But talk a little about that arc in general. I'm just kind of curious, you know.
Yeah, I went into politics. I right out of college, while I was in college, I started working for U.S. Senator George McGovern.
Mm-hmm.
And then went to work with Congressman Tom Daschle, who became the Senate Majority Leader. And so I was very active in campaigns. I was running campaigns, and then I was doing so much in campaign work that I became a PR consultant and, you know, a strategist for campaigns. And I was doing so much work that I actually went out and bought a printing company. That's how I got started in the printing business. And then I took that and built that, you know, 4X'd it in about 4 years. And then that led me to, into the lobbying. I was starting to doing a lot of lobbying business at that same time. I've always have a couple of hats in the ring at any given time doing not more than one business, as John alluded to early. I'm like, oh my God, he went to lunch, he started another one. And so back then I owned a cell phone company, a printing company, a design company. I got in some real estate businesses, and then, you know, that led me to one thing to another, which then led me to buy and sell over 250 companies in my career, and about 25 billion in transactions. That led me, you know, all the way up through, doing work for Kodak and Xerox and Canon and all the printing companies, and then eventually took a spot inside of Eastman Kodak back in 2006. So that's kind of the progression there, Martin. Politics to printing to now working with C-suite executives.
So I can imagine, you know, as somebody that is essentially an entrepreneur, what you're describing to me, did you find it stultifying, difficult to work within Kodak? Did you have to stymie down that kind of entrepreneurial drive, that kind of willingness to be flexible?
It was tough. I mean, don't get me. I mean, I say to all the naysayer opportunists, obstructionists to, stand in the way of progress, when I come in or I'm coming around, note, we will beat you. I will find a way to crush you. I mean, that's always been my mantra. So, and inside of Kodak, that was my job. My job was to come in and really to shake it up. And luckily I had a CEO, who was my boss, who was very supportive of that. And I learned a great deal from him. And I actually wrote to him the other day that I don't think I've ever learned as much as I did as when I was a CMO of Kodak in such a short period, in 4 years. I mean, I was, at that time, young in my, young 40s, in my mid 40s there. And like, boom, man, did I learn. And, but yeah, it's tough when you're in those big corporate things, lots of rigid things. You gotta be really good at working the system. It's like first day I was there, I had a conference room. I brought a customer came in, sat down on a chair. The chair was broken. He fell over, hit his head, cut his head open, had to take him away in an ambulance, So it's like, why are these chairs broken? And they said, well, they've been broken for a long time because they've been on budget cuts and we can't spend money. And I go, order me 12 new chairs. And then my secretary came back almost crying the next day, said, Mr. Hazel, I can't do that. I want to do what you say, but I can't do it. And I go, why? He said, well, we can't order 12 chairs. Why? Well, we're only allowed to order six. I said, well, then put in two orders of six, which I did. And then a month later, I have the comptroller coming after me. I mean, literally coming after me. You have to go before a board review and all this kind of crap when you do stuff like this. And, and they said, you can't do that. I said, yeah, I can. That's what your rules say. Your rules said, you can't buy 12 chairs. I didn't buy 12 chairs. I bought two orders of six. And that's what your rules say. And, so you just have to learn how to work around that system and bend the rules and push. And that's what, as a CMO, chief marketing officer, that was my job. My job was to become the chief tension officer in the company. And I did it really well.
Chief tension officer.
Yeah. I felt that chief tension officer thing a few times. I used to run out to Stump Down Coffee Roasters and I'd say, what do you need? And you'd order a black coffee with four espressos.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, well, that's a light thing.
No, I got to admit something to you, Jeffrey. I would only get two espressos in it.
Oh, gosh. That's why I was still hooked on five-hour energy drinks at the same time.
Your blood pressure and my blood pressure were at stake. So, hey, before we wrap up, and I hate to wrap up, I don't want to leave without some more impressions of you in Ireland. And also, how was it that you got that first trip to Ireland underway?
Are you kidding me?
So how did that happen?
You were part of that.
Absolutely. So I just want you to recount, where did that first ticket come from?
Well, from you, John. So it was so cool because it was a Christmas party night. The Irish Business Organization has their annual Christmas gathering and dinner. But you said, hey, Jeff, I want you to come to the party. And I said, absolutely want to come to the party. Been a member, want to go. And he goes, and then you buy a ticket for, $100, a chance to win this trip to Ireland. Fine. Absolutely. And then, but I told you I couldn't go because I'm also being recognized as one of the top 100 most influential Irish Americans by the magazine. And their banquet was the same night. So crap. But I found out the banquet was like a block away. So I went to the fancy smancy thing first. Okay. And got my award, took the picture, did all that stuff and ate the dinner. And, as soon as I got to the main course, I got to go. And I left with my wife, Tammy, because I want to go down to IBO because the Irish Business Organization is a lot more fun. And these are my peeps. And so, boom, I get there. And they said, hey, you want to buy another ticket? I said, yeah, what the heck? I was feeling pretty giddy. I've already had a few pops already at the other thing. So yeah, having a great time. And then they do the drawing and I win the trip. And so that was the first time I got to take my wife to Ireland and just enjoy ourselves. And so we went and we spent together 2 weeks. We took 1 week with just us and toured around. And then my brother came and his wife and my stepsister and her husband came. And it is by far the best trip I've ever had in my entire life. And all we did was stay in bed and breakfasts and really nice places. I went to Ashford Castle and I flew with the Hawks and
I've done that
went
too.
Fly fishing. I sat in the same bar as the Quiet Man and drank scotch, drank 30-year-old scotch all night, drank an entire bottle over 2 days. You know, not that I'm a big drinker, but I enjoy having a nice time. I met so many great people there. I had so many good times. I'm still corresponding with people I met. You know, I got a car rental from Dan Dooley. You know, I drove all over Ireland. And then I spent a lot of time in Derry and up in the northern coast, and of course some time in Belfast and Dublin as well. And but Derry, I really enjoyed Derry. I really enjoyed the tooling around, seeing my name.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah, on tombstones and stuff and. An experience, you know, I have in my office right now, I have a jar full of water from the Roe River that I smuggled back. And I have from the farm, or, you know, the ancestral farm where my relatives first came from, where, you know, he was a pastor and a minister, was a minister at a nearby church before his wife passed. And he gave his baby up to his younger brother and he went to America. And he took my great-great-great-grandfather, his younger brother, who was never going to inherit the farm. He took him and took him to America, and that's how we got there. And so, and I have a tin can, a coffee can, you know, full of dirt from that farm, and then rocks that I took. I brought rocks back, John and Martin, rocks back in my bag, and they sit here on my desk as a reminder of me of where. You know, where you come from, a little bit of Ireland.
So a question on that front, you know, as a young guy going in Ireland, we'd see, American tourists coming in and talking about, you know, tracking down their roots and blah, 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 blah. I get it now. I've been living in this country for like 36, 37 years. But can you explain to Irish listeners why that is so important to you? Why is that important to Americans?
Well, you know, America has it's a different culture. You know, we believe in America. How do I say this without getting too emotional? We believe in the institution of America, the land of the free. But we all came here from somewhere else. Not a one of us, very few, even the Native Americans, first Americans, they came from other places and took over from other people as well. But then tens of thousands of years later, we showed up and we all came from different places and different cultures and different backgrounds. And we had to leave it all behind. We had to escape it. Almost everybody fought, you know, left from famine or from oppression or from from never allowed to be free. And America was that destination place. But what did you give up? What was that like? What were, you know, there's so many questions that you want to have, that you want to ask, that you never had. Martin, if you stayed in Ireland, you were there and your family never left, you got to see all that. You got to experience it. You got to know the stories. You got to know the music. You got to know the food. You got to know the spirits. You got to know everything, that what it was like to breathe in the air and touch the trees and to walk the ground. And my family had to leave that for something else. And so that gives you a chance to touch that and to be that and to be in their shoes again. I was once a business partner with Sheldon Adelson, one of the richest men in the world.
Casino man.
Yeah, the casino. He used to own the Comdex show, which he sold. I helped him sell, and he sold for $900 million. And now he owns the Venetian Hotels and one of the richest men in the world. And one day I called him and he was in Israel. I said, "What are you doing, Sheldon?" And he goes, "I'm on the beach." "What are you on the beach for?" He says, He says, my father could never go to Israel. And of course, he's Jewish. My father could never go to Israel, and I'm walking the beach in a pair of his shoes.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see an American, an Irish American, come back to Ireland, that's what we're doing. We're walking in those same shoes, and in a metaphorical kind of way. And I think that's the thing.
I think that's about as eloquently stated as I can imagine.
Beautiful, really. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I hadn't thought about it until you just asked me. So I'm glad you think that. I just can't wait. It's a magical place. It's a beautiful place. But you see this, and you people say, well, Irish people are so nice. Well, they're nice everywhere in the world. But to be where the blood is from, you can't beat that. You can't put a price on that. So that's why.
Nice wrap on the Irish experience there, Jeffrey. One of the things I'd like to steal from working with you on All Business with Jeffrey Hazlett was the shameless plug idea. And, you know, where should people go to learn more about you, the C-suite, all your various media properties? What's the best guide to?
Well, you can go to hazlett.com, HAYZLETT.com, or C-suite. SUITE, so csuitenetwork.com, and you can find all things there, all things C-Suite, C-Suite Radio, C-Suite Book Club, you know, C-Suite TV, everything you need to know. That's where we're at.
It's just tremendous having you on, Jeffrey. You're at the upper tier of the podcasting world, and Martin and I are just getting our start, but really fantastic conversation. And I'd just like to throw in one last thing, and then I'll hand it over to Martin. You talked about Kodak, and you learned more in 4 years than you ever learned anywhere else. I learned more in 2 years working for you than I ever learned anywhere else.
You're very kind. Thank you, John. I appreciate that.
And I'd just like to ask the most important question. What kind of whiskey do you drink?
Well, if it's good whiskey, it's Jameson. I like Jameson Black. Bushmills is great. Of course, Red Robin's also good. But if it's really, Jameson's my go-to whiskey any day. And Jameson Black is my favorite. And then, of course, as you heard, I'm very partial to scotches as well, which is kind of like drinking Irish.
Yep. And I'll throw in a bit of trivia at the end, okay? So the question to the other two gentlemen is what's the relationship between technology, Jameson, and Italy?
Wow. I don't know this because my wife is from Italy, and I know Jeffrey had an experience traveling to Italy, which was on that sort of scale of how we felt going to Ireland, right, Jeffrey? You had a great
time. Totally. Yeah.
Technology.
Well, let me be a bit more specific. Radio, Italy, and Jameson.
Okay, so Marconi would be in there somewhere, right?
It's got to be Marconi in the middle of that. So
that is correct. And guess what Marconi married into?
Oh, the Jameson family.
That's right.
Correct.
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Wow.
You see, we learn on this show, Jeffrey. We learn.
We learn something new every day. Well, you probably learn that while drinking Jameson. That's probably the thing.
I am susceptible.
Yeah. It's been known to happen.
Maybe even a Jameson and ginger. Oh, that sounds good. I got to go.
Yeah, I hear you. Jeffrey, I'd just like to thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation. It's always a pleasure to learn something new, and I've learned a whole bunch of new things. So, from the Irish Stew, thank you so much for joining us, and I'll leave it to John.
I think we can all end on the same word. Sláinte.
Is gan Éirí an Bóthar leat.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, you get the idea. Jeffrey Hazlett has done this before. He's a natural. You know, he's just... tell him to get going, and we're off to the races. I did work for Jeffrey for 2 years. It was a pivotal time in my life. Learned an awful lot from him. He's a force of nature. He's a relentlessly organized guy. He makes every minute count for him. And one of the reasons he does that is so he can enjoy a good life out in his spread of land out in South Dakota with his family. Always enjoy talking with Jeffrey, and it's been great keeping in touch with him.
I would say Jeff lacks a little bit of energy, don't you think? But you know what I've found really interesting, and I use the term all the time, a Kodak moment, and usually I use that to refer to companies that have been hugely successful, and then they hit the speed bump to end all speed bumps, and usually to end the actual company. And of course, that's what happened to Kodak. And so it was really kind of cool to be actually able to talk to somebody that had been at Kodak when the Kodak moment happened. What Jeff revealed about it is how organizations can really hem themselves in, put themselves in a straitjacket that they can't escape. And he kind of referred to Kodak as seeing itself as a film company. And of course, what happened to film? Film processing, it went away. It went away when the iPhone started kicking in big time, and it happened way faster than they expected. And because it happened way faster than they expected, they got caught with their pants down. And what they really should have been focusing on was actually being an imaging company, because that, in truth, was what the Kodak moment was really originally about. And I've kind of appropriated that in a very different way. But the Kodak moment was that special moment. And what better way to catch or capture a special moment than with a great picture or a great image, whether it's with a digital camera or a film camera.
And of course, they're the ones who invented the digital camera. So they really, really lost out on this one. You can kind of put yourself back in that, in their mindset. What a massive, massive infrastructure they had for the manufacture, distribution, processing, and sale of film. Pretty hard to turn that corner, and they weren't able to do it successfully. You know, one other thing, bringing it back to the topic of the show, the global Irish nation, it was really great because I was there when Jeffrey really figured out he was Irish. You know, he's a guy who moved around the country as a kid, didn't exactly know where his roots were. And as we talked about how he did some genealogical research, he figured out he's more than half Irish. And boy, did he embrace it in a big way. Really took to Irish culture, spoke at the Irish Business Organization, won our trip to Ireland. He really embraced it, and it was great to watch.
Yeah, you know what was really cool? I asked that question about why do Americans come to Ireland? Why is that important? And they say, I'm looking for my roots. And most Irish people, or many Irish people, will kind of roll their eyes. So I asked Jeff to explain that, and he was very eloquent. And interestingly, he started off with a story about Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate from Las Vegas. And the story went along the lines of Adelson wearing his father's shoes so he could walk on behalf of his father on the seashore in Israel, because his father never had the opportunity to do that. And that tells you something about Adelson, and also the importance of paying tribute to those ancestors that came before you. And what that does is it keeps people grounded. So walking in the shoes of one's ancestors keeps you humble. It avoids your getting stuck on yourself. And so paying homage to those people that came before you is an important thing. And I recommend that to everybody, whether they're American or whether they're Irish in Ireland.
Speaking of paying homage, there's one guy that got mentioned, a high-profile name in the world today. And I don't know if he really was paid homage by Jeffrey, but what was the quote of the day, in your opinion, from this podcast?
Well, you can't really walk away from the whole notion of batshit crazy when it refers to the current president of the United States. But you know what was also funny was, on one level, Jeffrey called him batshit crazy, but on another level, he said, well, he's my friend. And he made a distinction that you can be a friend with somebody, but certainly not agree with them politically. And of course, Jeffrey's background, as he laid out, was in democratic politics, and apparently continues to be the case. But what else was interesting about him talking about our current political environment was he felt that Trump was beneficial, which kind of surprised me. But what he was kind of getting at was, all of a sudden now people are actually passionate about politics versus disinterested. Now, he also kind of made a qualifying point that he didn't like the invective, the intolerance the violent disagreement that we see playing out in the news. So there's a distinction there. But the point is, to have a great democracy, you have to have some passion.
Absolutely. Well, let's wrap it up. And I think, you know, as I know, Jeffrey, I'm going to leave you with one thought of his that I think encapsulates his philosophy in business and in life. And it was the title of one of his books, Think Big, Act Bigger. Thanks for joining us for another Global Irish Nation Conversation. To see what we're stirring up next, follow us on Twitter at Irish Stewcast or like us on Facebook at Irish Stew Podcast. And you're very welcome to join Martin Nutty and me, John Lee, anytime for another serving of Irish Stew.
Irish Stew is produced by John Lee, Martin Nutty, and Bill Schultz. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Bill Schultz. Music on Irish Stew was composed and performed by Rosa Nutty, with Donald Bowens on drums, Cathal O'Riordan on bass and synthesizer. For more on Rosa Nutty's music, please visit rosanutty.com.